The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job has just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Oh, God, damn it.
Oh, my God.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter. And I'm a writer. Bud. Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. We have Joanna Novak here with us. Her short story collection, Meaningful Work, won the Ronald Sekenik Innovative Fiction Contest. She is the author of three books of poetry, most recently New Life, out on Black Lawrence Press, and a novel, I Must Have You. Her debut memoir, Contradiction Days, will be published by Catapult in 2023. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Paris Review, The New York Times, and other publications. She is a co-founder of the literary journal and chapbook publisher, Tammy. Welcome, Joanna.
Welcome.
Hey, Lindsay. Hey, Alex. It's great to be here.
This is so exciting.
Awesome.
I'm sorry that you've only ever been published in these podunk places, but I have faith that things are going to turn around.
We'll try. We'll keep trying.
Yeah, keep trying. Okay. No one can take anything away from you. What are you going to read to us?
You know, I think I am going to read a story for Meaningful Work that I have never read before, but it is a story filled with food, and therefore I love it.
Yes.
So it is called Lamb Goat Tongue. This originally appeared in the Bennington Review, so much gratitude to them.
Awesome.
Lamb Goat Tongue. His landlady stopped him after she parked the van. Usually five children spilled out, but now only the woman heaved herself from the driver's seat. She must have weighed twice as much as the man. He was trim, she was not. He fasted until dinner time. Relics of fast food littered her car. In-N-Out bags, Hardee's cups. Once he'd seen a full box of Taco Bell nachos, beef. Breathless, the landlady greeted him with purpose. It was the first of the month. He was a good tenant, a listener. Her smile went from curious to coy. Then she asked him, "Do you like goat?" The man shifted his groceries. He was in the middle of making enchiladas. In a pot on the stove, cumin and oregano and cayenne tinged the oil brown. It was time for next steps. Sandra was on her way home. "I don't know," he said. "Well, this goat you'll like, you'll love," the landlady said. Her purple eyeshadow made her look young. "This is the best goat in Los Angeles. You guys want some?" The man said sure, even though Sandra said she did not eat meat. The enchiladas were vegetarian, shiitake and sweet potato, because she said she did not eat meat. Their fridge, however, often did have meat. His turkey, his chicken. Sometimes he wondered if she ate it. Goat would be no different, though he felt a little desperate accepting random meat from a van. "This too." The landlady handed him a plastic bag knotted at the top with a carton inside. The inside of the bag was wet. Goat juice. She told him to mix it with some beans and rice and enjoy. "Let me know how Sandra likes it," the landlady said. The man found space in the fridge next to cashew milk and orange mostarda. As he listened to sketches of Spain, his love for Sandra swelled. She said she did not eat meat, fine. She said she did not sleep well, also fine. She said she did not want children. She'd said it the other day at 6 a.m., at 6 p.m., at midnight. He put that out of his mind. He spread enchilada sauce on the bottom of a casserole pan. Outside his window, the quintuplets squealed, and then the landlady's parenting voice deepened. No, get in the van. Just as the enchiladas were ready, he heard heels on the asphalt. He commended his timing. Through the window by the stove, he watched the crown of Sandra's head while she climbed the stairs, the first flight. The apartment smells wonderful, she said. She kept on her work clothes, which she preferred. No mention of the music. The plate he set in front of her, she complimented. He'd centered the enchiladas, sprinkled them with the salty cheese she liked, cilantro. The baby grape tomatoes had been in the oven blistering. He asked about her day. After she told him, he spoke about the questions that could be asked of the president. They lived in a nation. They were citizens in a world beyond the two of them, and he did his civic duty, processing the news. He was surprised she used the word collusion. He laid down his knife and fork, intersecting, she parallel. She said she didn't want more. Another corn tortilla won't kill you, he said, getting a second helping. She just took garnishes. Did you see the lamb in the fridge, he asked. She licked something off her bottom lip. I haven't been in the fridge, she said. He sat down. There's a box of lamb in a container. He told her about the landlady, how this was the best lamb in Los Angeles. Then he felt angry because Sandra looked at him like, okay, when really there should be room for a husband to explain to his wife an abundance of strange meat in the fridge. Perhaps because of his anger, he spent a long time meditating in the courtyard. And while meditating in the courtyard, he opened the communal grill the landlady had shown him. And there it was, a nipper of Smirnoff he kept expecting a neighbor to nick. He mined the deep well of his thoughts, and his mouth stung, worse than from the cayenne in the sauce. He recycled the bottle and returned to the apartment where Sandra was working. He fell asleep sitting up on the couch. Of course, marriage is composed of many mornings, and the man found the next one peaceful. It was brighter than yesterday, and he even saw a hummingbird outside their bedroom window. He meditated in the courtyard again, and this time the meditation came with clarity. He saw himself teaching a child to wrap mushrooms inside tortillas, Sandra showing the child how to use a potato peeler. He came back to the apartment, certain this was the greatest day of his life. In the kitchen, Sandra dumped water into the Chemex. Goat coffee, he said. Pretty wife. Goat? You didn't want goat coffee? She put down the water, waiting for the grounds to settle. You said lamb. I said it was goat, he said. She shook her head, smiling how she smiled when she was about to get upset. Their counselor had used the phrase lash out. Lamb. She said goat, I said goat. I know it's goat, he said. I don't know what you heard. You said lamb, she said. But I didn't. You're wrong, she said, but it doesn't matter. The ground settled. She poured them both coffee. When it was time for her to leave for work, he offered her the leftovers. You think if you feed me enough enchiladas, you'll make me want to get pregnant, she said. Her heels shot down the steps toward the car. He opened the fridge, stared at the meat, and truly couldn't recall if it was lamb or goat. Often he had visions during meditations. Recently, he'd watched himself cutting out Sandra's tongue. In the vision, there weren't any repercussions to the violence, neither guilt nor its wiser progeny, remorse. Just choice, decision, action, a red solipsistic stake on the ground. No regrets. Only in his hand, their serrated knife. Thanks.
Thank you so much. I was saying before we started recording, how much I love when poets write fiction and memoir, as you have done and are doing, because the care and the tenderness and the precision and the wildness and the, I don't know, there's just
say in a moment.
Yeah. There's just like different permission structures, I feel. I was just reading the Benjamin Labatut book, When We Cease to Understand the World. And one of the scientists that he talks about in that book says, in order to understand my work, you have to unlearn everything you've ever learned. And I feel like that's kind of how poets approach fiction or memoir, is they're coming at it from such a different, you know, thinking space. See, I'm not a poet.
Yeah.
And you had, this collection of stories that you just read from, and then your third book of poetry, New Life, came out last year. Right. So that's major. And I want to kind of hear from you what that was like to put out a collection of stories and a book of poetry at the same time on different presses. Were you working on them at the same time? What was that like?
Yeah, for sure. It was a really odd way to kick off the pandemic, actually, just to get notice that the short story collection had won the Sukhanik Prize. And then about 6 weeks later, I found out that New Life had been selected from Black Lawrence's open reading period.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was just a very, and actually in between there, I sold the memoir to Catapult. So it was I had a friend who was like, buy a lottery ticket. Buy lots of lottery tickets. So it was incredible. And kind of like staggering, you know, like afterwards I was like, well, now what? You know, because it just sort of felt like a really exciting thing. But also there was the pandemic happening, and that kind of like mitigated a lot of like excitement that one might feel, I suppose, because the world was in chaos. So but it was a really it was a great experience to work with both FC2 and New Life, and Black Lawrence. I mean, they're both like such established presses, and they have such interesting histories. But also it was like weird to put out two books in 1 year, you know, because you feel like you're kind of like dividing your love a little bit.
How far apart were they released, Joanna?
So Meaningful Work came out in August, and then New Life came out in December.
Oh, wow.
So really pretty close.
Yeah.
Do you find that there's overlap, like when you're working on fiction, poetry, memoir, and also like when you're talking about it, you know, at like your release events, or, you know, like, do they sort of meld together in your mind, or are they very separate to you?
I think some of the like technical things are pretty similar. I mean, I'm a really, I think I'm a pretty Baroque writer at times, and that shows up in my work regardless of genre. So like, I feel like on that level, like we could talk about like the sort of like decadence of language in any genre, and it would feel like pretty true. But in terms of like the process of working on the books, so Meaningful Work was composed over like, I think, decades. The oldest story in there is a story I wrote my first semester in college. And anyone who, you know, studies creative writing and then gets an MFA and maybe even another MFA, like, one is writing stories and adding stories and like subtracting stories from their collection that they're potentially building. So the collection was really in progress for a long, long time. And I just happened to send it out to the Sukhanik Prize in 2019. New Life, on the other hand, I wrote in a really concentrated way. Over a couple months. I guess in the middle of being pregnant, I was like really concerned that I wouldn't be productive ever again after I had my baby. So I was like writing like really, really like in a very concerted manner, like these poems all titled New Life. And I've never worked on a book like that. And it was so exciting, like to have that kind of focus that one would bring to like a novel or maybe like a longer prose project. Bringing that focus to like a book of poetry was really a cool experience.
Do you think that fear you had, because I know your memoir deals with that as well, with prenatal depression and worrying about, you know, maintaining that side of yourself. Do you think that came from like something you knew about yourself or something you had heard from other parents? Like where do you think that came from?
I think it came from respecting, having a lot of like writer role models who were sort of like proudly anti-children. And like, I don't need to name names. There are lots and lots of them. And then also being someone who was like, I don't want kids my whole life. And then having like a real turning point moment.
That happened to me too. Oh my God.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
It was like, I don't think about having epiphanies a lot, but like the moment when I decided, like realized that I did want to have a baby was like a very epiphanic moment. I was like out for a run. It was really hot. The sun was like, you know, streaming down on me. And I was like, oh, that would be okay.
Yes, it literally is a biological urge. It's like, and it's unavoidable. For me, it was. It's just like, oh my God, I have to have a baby. I must go make baby now.
Yeah. So that was like really hard though, to like go from being somebody who had been like the person that in my family or among my friends was so like hardcore against children, mm-hmm. you know, like kind of switching that part of my identity was really like frightening for me. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel like that my fears have really like panned out, I suppose.
Mm. How old is your baby now?
He is a little over two years, 4 months. Yeah.
Okay. Things are getting better. Yes.
He's been an easy baby.
Excellent.
I'm interested in what your actual writing days looked like when you were working in such a concentrated way. Did you have like a very set schedule? Were you trying to like, you know, drink the same kind of tea every day? Were you making coffee at the same time? What did it actually look like? And did you from the outset have a sense that this was going to be a very like set project with a very like, did it feel like this is, I kind of know where the end point is of this and kind of like running a race almost.
And similarly, I'd love if you could talk about how you structured it as well. And if you knew that right away, or if that was something that sort of happened as you worked.
Yeah, for sure. So when I was working on New Life, I was working pretty much from whatever time I could get myself up in the morning. And before having my son, I was like very, very disciplined about getting up at like 4 or 4:30 or something. And I would work for 2 or 2.5 hours at my desk, decaf espresso because I was pregnant. and I would just sort of set a time. I would work by time. I would work for about 2 hours or until like 7 o'clock. And then I might return to the work during the day, or I might turn to other kinds of writing that I was doing at the time, maybe like an essay or stories, or I kind of switch between projects sometimes. But in the morning, I was just giving those first couple few hours to the manuscript. And I did that for about 2 months, and that got me to a draft of the book. Then I shared the manuscript with a couple of readers, took some time off, went to New Mexico where coincidentally I wrote like a really fast first draft of the memoir that I later sold. And then I had after I had a draft of this memoir, I was like, okay, it's time to like really shape this book of poetry. And I did the same sort of thing where I was kind of getting up early, working for a few hours in the morning. And how I decided to put it into 5 sections, I honestly don't remember. Like, I don't remember the sort of logic behind structuring the book. I knew it couldn't be in 3 sections because I thought it would be really annoying to have it in trimesters. But it felt like those 5 sections provided like these like mini movements in the book, and these sort of phases. And I also was kind of cognizant of, so running throughout the book are these poems, N is for blank, N is for nurture, N is for nature. And so I was obviously thinking about distributing those evenly throughout the sections and things like that. Yeah, that's not a very exciting answer to the structure question, I'm afraid.
No, I think it's an answer. Okay. I just thought it was really beautiful when you get to the second section and it starts talking about your mother, or the narrator's mother, I should say, can't assume it's, but you know, it just deepens it. And I guess my, you know, a question that's sort of tied to that is, you know, you sat down and you were disciplined. Did you have an idea in your head of like, of it as a whole, or these ideas you wanted to explore, or did they come to you as you went? Did you have sort of like a starting point, or were you just like, I remember we were talking to Rachel Yoder about Night Bitch and she was like, I just had things to say. And like, they just kept coming. Or for you, was it like, I have this overarching idea that I want to explore?
I think there's something really, something really resonant about the idea of like, there are things to say. And it felt like this was a kind of like, I can't oversell how just like sure I was that my life would be over when I had a baby. And so it really felt like, this is it. I better get it out. Like, I better say what I have to say about, you know, like the pregnant body and motherhood. And, I was thinking a lot about like my husband's sort of companion experience, like becoming a father and like, you know, like what sort of legacy I would be responsible for passing on to our child about, you know, like his, you know, my husband's past and things like that. And so it felt really like there was, like if I didn't write, I would like regret it later. And yeah, I was also like, without getting too into the memoir, I suppose, like I was really depressed in my first trimester and I couldn't write. I was having a hard time writing like sustained prose in a way that I was happy with. Mm-hmm. And so like writing poems felt like, okay, I can manage this and I can write a poem a day. And, you know, like I can like take from whatever's around me. And like, I happen to be doing things like watching a lot of strange movies or like, you know, forcing myself to watch Rosemary's Baby and like, which is what every mother to be should do. And so like that kind of material was like really, like alive in my consciousness.
I'm really interested in the, and I'm not going to, cause it just occurred to me, it's not going to come out right. But there's this parallel between, deciding to have a child and immediately filling with fear and also like being too depressed to write, but still writing one poem a day, you know, like, I feel like there's this like yin yang of like, I know I'm not saying it correctly, but something about just the beauty of how, and I'm sorry, Alex, but mothers keep going.
I don't apologize.
Well, I know, you know, we can talk about your side of it all day long. I know.
No, we don't have to. No.
But what I'm saying is, it's something beautiful about these choices. And then also these things that aren't choices, that are just necessary, to like who you really are, you know, like individually. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I could say it better, but.
No. I think you're saying it really well. I mean, I think it feels like it's in certain times in life, like writing really reminds me of like, and I'm surely not alone in this, but like writing is a great reminder of like sort of human resilience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I would love to also talk about your collection and how you put that together, considering that's a much different, like you were saying, a much longer project. You know, like how did you decide what stories to keep Was it sort of like, because I know how I am. If I write a story, I'm like, well, this is going in the collection. I don't care. You know, like I made some pages. It's going in. and then it's up to like an editor down the line to be like, what the hell is this? but, you know, like, did the theme of it change over time? You know, like, how did that, what did that process look like?
Yeah, you know, I think it had a few different titles, like, over the years. A much earlier version of this manuscript was a finalist for, like, the Sarah Bonde, it was a Mary McCarthy Prize. I think it was titled Secrets then, and I felt too coy, and, like, I just, I think that I was really interested in, I think I was interested in the work that ended up being sort of more, in some ways, like, plainly autofictional. Like, there are a lot of characters in this collection who have either names that are like bastardizations of my name or like of my first name or my last name, who maybe share a lot of biographical details with me or like places of employ. And so I found that to be a like really kind of anchoring way for me to put the collection together. And then I suppose I was also like really, I love collections. Like, one that always stands out to me is like Jane Ann Phillips's Black Tickets. Like,
oh,
that toggle
fuck yes.
between
classic. Oh my God.
Yeah, I love the oscillation between long and short, especially with writers whose prose is also really sumptuous, you know, and Phillips is like so sumptuous. And so that kind of like switching between length, like switching in length, felt really like something I was paying particular attention to. So yeah, I was thinking about that, and then the final piece in the collection is this, like, it was published originally as this little chapbook from Dancing Girl Press, like, many years ago, and it's called Something Real, and it's sort of like a kaleidoscopic view of, like, I guess imagined selves or something like that. And so it felt like I knew I wanted to end with that piece, because I also love when collections have a sort of longer standalone, either series or novella, that concludes things. I don't know. So that's some stuff I was thinking about. And I know I was like weighing, like, you know, the movement between first and second and third person, because the stories do kind of oscillate between those points of view. So, like, making sure that like two second persons weren't like back to back, so the second persons could still be distinct, was important, which isn't really a very glamorous thing, but it feels like a practical concern.
No, it feels like a poet's concern, right? Like, you're like, well, this, you know, like this line break or this word is too rhyming with this other, you know, it makes total sense to me.
There was also like, I know I was thinking about sort of like, it's not a perfect logic, but like, I was thinking about the age of the characters, and there are some stories in this collection where the protagonist is like an adolescent or in high school. It felt important to kind of like let those characters have their own sort of area in the book in some way. And like the adult characters could like be at the adult table and the kids can be at the kids' tables, even though like the themes are really consistent throughout. So I don't know that that really makes a lot of difference, but it felt nice for me to sort of separate them.
I was going to ask Joanna how you came across Jane Ann Phillips' work first, because Black Tickets is a book that I do not remember how it ended up in my lap, but it's one that meant a lot to me, especially early on when I was writing short stories. And I can think of some of the other, you know, writers I was reading at the time, people like Pinkney Benedict, like Town Smokes, I remember was a book I had picked up, and some of the Frederick Bartholomew, like Moon Deluxe type stuff. But I don't remember how exactly I arrived at Jane Ann Phillips. Do you remember how you came across her work?
Yeah, I think so. My first fiction writing professor in college recommended I read Black Tickets. My very first creative writing class. And I think it was definitely after this one story that's in the collection called Memo 19 that is about a sort of like gang rape fantasy and very dark, very, very lyric. And I think that was a real, like, it felt like that gave the professor cause to be like, you should really read Jane Ann Phillips and Mary Gateskill and everybody else who was writing about things that were, you know, falling under the bad behavior rubric.
Right. God. Yeah. It's kind of amazing how those first few recommendations can really shape a writing life in a lot of ways. And just like the way you even think about putting together your own work for years and years after, it's great that these people are out there still saying these names out loud, because I think Jane Ann Phillips is a name I hadn't heard in a long time, but I was so happy when you said Black Tickets. I was like, oh my God, yes.
Yeah. Oh, and Wedding Picture is like a story that I used to teach all the time. Like,
oh, cool.
The first story in that collection is just absolutely phenomenal. And what she does in like 70 words or whatever that story consists of is like more than, you know, I think a lot of writers can manage in many more pages. Like, she's just so potent. So she stayed with me for sure.
That's awesome.
I would love to hear you talk a little bit about your work history, because you had a pretty hellish adjuncting time in your life. And, you know, in addition to all the menial jobs that we have to undertake to feed ourselves as we're trying to follow these, you know, writing paths. What was that like? Where are you now?
I have had a lot of jobs, and I often feel like a workaholic. It's like an energizing problem, I suppose. Being like overcommitted often makes me feel like I write sort of more furiously and more urgently. My first job was when I was 14 at the snack bar at Timber Trail Swim Club. Yes. That job consisted largely of warming up frozen churros in oven. Yeah. Or like building boats of nachos for people. sometimes scraping out the like pizza char that was also in the pizza oven.
Eating it.
And no, it was so gross. It had the worst smell.
I don't do that either.
Yeah. No, but the best thing that I had to do at that job was for some reason at this snack bar, it was protocol. It was custom, I suppose, to sell Swedish fish in bags of 10, and they were not pre-bagged Swedish fish. They were not like a package of M&Ms.
Did you have like a Swedish fish tongs or something?
I had to wear a glove and
a Swedish glove. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, there are these like baseball card sleeves into which would count 10 Swedish fish and then like fold over the top, seal it with scotch tape, and then line them up in the empty Swedish fish box.
And one tab of acid.
And I loved that task. My like compulsive little anorexic mind was like, this is heaven. I'm going to count fish all day. See how fast I can do it. I love that.
Did you get weird with colors? Was it like, all right, here's a blue pack, here's a red pack, or were you just like
all red? It was all red fish.
All Swedish fish are red, Alex.
Oh, Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah, it's not like Sour Patch Kids. They're all red.
I'm not locked into the candy, I guess. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I didn't know about Swedish fish, I swear, until I moved to the Midwest. It wasn't like a thing in Florida. Pixie Sticks was the thing. Okay.
That sounds Florida. Yeah.
And we did snort it.
Of course.
But yeah, that was my first job. And then I like worked a bunch of different like food jobs. Everything from like being a waitress at like a little bistro in college to scooping ice cream at Cold Stone Creamery to slicing bagels at Great American Bagel. Mm-hmm. I worked in a hardware store for a while and a lighting store. Between MFAs, I got really desperate and was like a wedding registry girl at Macy's. And like,
what does that mean? Can you say more about that? That job, I'm like, I want to hear a lot more about Macy's.
Well, I helped brides-to-be sign up for their wedding registries and tried to convince them that they needed to register for China.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I signed up for the dumbest shit. I wish I could go back in time and redo my wedding because I never thought about getting married or having a wedding. My whole life, I just thought it was stupid. And so then it was time to get married. I just like did what I thought you were supposed to do. And I just registered for like a random end table, like one end table, you know, and then like, just like random stuff. And I just wish I could go back and be like, like, send us money to go on our honeymoon or donate to the manatees, you know, like
the manatees need it more than
that's any right.
of us
they,
do.
They really do. They really do.
Yeah, that was a job I had just for like 3 or 4 months before I got on like the adjunct hamster wheel in Massachusetts. And yeah, it was just like a weird, sad little Macy's too in Holyoke Mall. The mall was dying around the Macy's and the Macy's was not doing much better. But it was a job that wasn't in food service. And like, I'd been in my first MFA, I started like working in pastry and I started doing a lot of like staging in fine dining in Chicago and working in pastry kitchens in St. Louis, where I was getting my MFA at WashU at the time. And after doing that for like 3 or 4 years, I was like, I can't probably keep working in kitchens because I don't have energy to write after like 10 or 12 hour shifts. Mm-hmm. And so switching from like kitchen work, back of the house work to like first Macy's and then like compulsive adjuncting was actually like a huge, like it really changed how I thought about myself as a writer. I just felt like so much more able to come to the page with like energy and not just like, and with sort of like a committed like with diligence rather than like when I could squeeze it in between like, you know, like sleeping after hauling a bunch of sheet pans or something like that.
Oh man.
Yeah.
I want to hear more about the hamster wheel, but I really need you to tell me why 2 MFAs.
Oh, well, because I heard it was possible.
Oh,
I think I heard that Mark Leidner had done it and I was like, okay.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. But seriously, I was like one of those people who went straight from undergrad to her MFA. And so I felt really young, like still by the time I finished that first MFA.
And was that in poetry?
My first MFA was in fiction.
In fiction. Okay.
Yeah. At WashU in St. Louis. And that program is really like very boundaried in that, or when I was there, like you couldn't take workshops that were not in your genre. Mm-hmm. And I would kind of find these classes that were like special topics courses that would let you, transgress the boundary, like the genre lines a little bit more. And I was taking those classes and writing prose poems and writing like flash fiction. And so I kind of was thinking like, I would love to get an MFA in poetry if someone would have me. And so I applied after finishing my MFA while I was like just working a pastry job in St. Louis and teaching a little at WashU. And I got into UMass and I was really fortunate. Like my first year, I didn't have to teach or anything there. I remember Peter Gizzi called me and was like, you'll get a little money, it's shoe money, but it's still something. And I was like, okay, thanks, Peter. But yeah, so when someone offers to let you come and get an MFA, and specifically at UMass, seemed like a great opportunity. It was a good decision.
And thus started your illustrious adjuncting professorial career.
Yeah. I mean, it was sort of like a thing that I feel like you kind of did if you were in Western Massachusetts, just because of the glut of institutions of higher education in that area. I mean, like, I think when I was at UMass, I was adjuncting at 3 or 4 different schools in addition to teaching at UMass.
Oh my gosh.
I had this like little circuit where I would go from like one school to another and basically teach like a high school teacher's kind of load in a day.
Jesus.
Yeah, but it is sort of Jesus, but it was also sort of like really quite a rush, because I would feel like, all right, like I hustled and I made a lot of money, I guess. And that was that was okay.
Yeah, making money is fine with me. I'm okay with that.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds really bad, but it also made me feel like I was really cognizant of the fact that if I taught during the year and was busy, then I would have nothing to do over the summers. You know, like I could give myself that time to be completely off or something. Mm-hmm. And then it also just happened to be, I just noticed that the more that I worked, the more I felt like industrious as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So it was good.
Who was John Brandon at WashU when you were there?
He was not. He came back though to do a reading. Oh, and cool. I remember it really clearly because he talked about how, was his book Florida? Is that?
Mm-hmm.
So he talked about how he had written that book while working at a windshield factory.
Oh my gosh.
And that always stayed with me. Like those stories of how writers find the time or make the time after or before or between, you know, like shifts. Those are really inspiring to me.
Same.
Yeah, I love that.
Well, tell us how you find the time now.
It's so much harder now than I have a kid. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like that's a really obvious thing to say. I think I find the time now by being willing to be like a little negligent about other things in my life.
Yeah.
Like if I have to choose between like having killer workout or writing, I'm definitely going to write. Mm-hmm. Like it's no question. And similarly, like with, you know, things that one might spend a lot of time on in terms of like grading or other kinds of like teaching related activities, I'm much speedier about those things. Even like responding to emails, like when you have a kid, I feel like you stop like really putting off sending emails that you have to resend, and you're just like, okay, got it. Good. Thanks.
Yep.
You know, like move on, because that's not work that really matters. Mm-hmm. But like, I think I still look for those pockets of time, whether it's the morning, which has become just harder for me. I don't know why, but, I'll stay up pretty late, like after everyone in my house is asleep, and I'll work, or, I do this thing, which feels like a little too like time optimizey for me, but I do it. I do like Pomodoro timers during the day where I'll set like a timer for 25 minutes and write and then break and then do that like 4 or 5 more times. Mm-hmm. If I feel like it's a day when it's really a busy day and getting the writing in is difficult. And then also I'm really fortunate because I have a husband who more than shares in childcare, and they have a wonderful babysitter who comes to our house like 4 or 5 days a week to help out. So,
oh, awesome.
You know, like that's a huge, huge, blessing. And I do not take it for granted.
Yeah, it's so funny. It's like after you become a parent, your thoughts about sleep and your thoughts about like time for yourself change so much, you know? And for a writer, like I remember if you guys know the writer Claire Zolke, she said, you don't like, I was asking her, my baby was like 6 weeks old. I was asking her like, when will I sleep again? And she was like, my therapist told me like, it's not about that you'll get back to the sleep that you had, but that you'll learn to appreciate the sleep that you now have. Oh my God. And it sounded like the doomiest, most horrific thing, but it's become more wise. Like the more children I acquire, the less sleep I get. I'm like, oh man, I got a real good chunk last night, you know, like, and same with time to yourself. It's like, oh yeah. Okay. You know, I got that 25 minutes in or whatever, those 500 words, whatever.
I think the other weird thing though about like, and I sometimes feel a little like traitorous to my writer self saying this, but like having I love being a mom like more than I ever would have anticipated. It's so fun. My son is just like a delight. We read stories and draw and like, it's just, he's a pretty great kid. And like, I often think to myself, like, do I want to be writing right now? Or do I want to be reading Madeline for the 15th time? And I, many, many times I'm like, I want to be reading Madeline for the 15th and 16th time, because there's going to be a time when he doesn't want to hear that,
right?
You know, the 12 little girls were in two straight lines breaking their bread. He's going to be like grown up, and then I will be able to write or read or do whatever I want. And like having the kind of like, you know, emotional experiences of being a mom feel often more valuable to me than like some of the writing that I think I could be doing, which, yeah, it feels traitorous to the writer self.
No, I really love that answer, because I think it, I mean, I was thinking of the things that replace writing for me, and they're definitely not as noble as what you just said, as far as actually being an engaged parent, but not that I'm not sometimes, but yeah, it's true. It's true. It's just a fact that I think a lot of times you, having children just kind of, it changes what you're forced to prioritize in the day in a very obvious way, but then also in smaller ways, like you're just saying. I mean, a lot of those moments, it gives you a long view on some of those moments that you maybe hadn't anticipated, for sure.
I think it's Michael Chabon who says that thing about like, if I hadn't had this number of kids, maybe I would have written this number of books more, but I would never choose those books over like having these kids. And I think, you know, like that sort of resonates with me. Like,
yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I read, I think I've said this on the pod before, but I read Steve Jobs's daughter's memoir. And she said, like, when he was dying, what he really regretted and what he would cry about and feel anguish about was that he didn't spend more time with her and with his other kids. It wasn't, I have more Apple inventions to do, or I have more, you know, it was, he should have spent more time with his family. And I don't know. I think about that all the time, because who changed the world more than him, you know? But that wasn't, at the end of his life, that wasn't what mattered. And it was too late for him, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
And on that note, on that horrible, sad note, is your memoir available for pre-order yet?
Not yet. No,
not
I'm
yet.
Still
okay.
I'm still working on edits right now. So it's like,
I'm asking you this in January of 2022, and it comes out in 2023, but
I appreciate the interest.
Yeah. It's on Catapult, everyone. So, you know, check again in 6 months, see if it's ready to pre-order. Thank you so much for being on. This was a true pleasure. And
thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Poetry, fans of fiction, fans of poets who write fiction, and prose writers who write poems, please check out Joanna's work. You will love it. So when I came down here to get ready for this, Parker plays this game on my computer sometimes that his school, it's like from a site that his school recommends.
Okay.
And it's a game called Wheelie. It's a problem solving game. Like there's no directions.
Awesome.
You just have to get like this little car to this red flag using what's on the screen. And so like it used to frustrate the hell out of him, drive him nuts. And he wanted to know exactly what to do, but slowly over time he's learned to like kind of sit with it and try to figure it out. Anyway, so he was doing that tonight during screen time and like on my laptop. And so when I came down here and opened up my computer, I saw, I've been writing and my work was just open to a sex scene. So God knows if he opened, if he went to go on Wheelie and read a little lesbian sex scene that his mom wrote, who knows?
How graphic is it?
Okay. I think there's, let's see. It's pretty, I mean, at first I was like, oh, this isn't so bad. And then I kept reading and I was like, oh, I mean, I guess he'd have to like really read. I don't think he did. Cause I think he would have come up.
Is that how he's wired? Like if he sat down and saw it, do you think he would just like lock in and read it?
I think he'd be like, ugh, what's this crap? You know, let me get to Wheelie. But I can't be sure.
Wheelie.
Yeah. Like he's never like my books, you know, are around the house and he's never been like, let me read these, you know? So,
right.
But it's just funny that it's like right there, some fingering,
just a little fingering, whatever.
So that's nice. Speaking of, I mentioned this to you, but I thought I would bring it up again, that I am writing a book, about a girl who flees the hurricane to, and she goes to Orlando anyway. And then Marcy Demansky just announced that she has a book coming out in June called Hurricane Girl. And it's basically the exact same premise. And you were like, oh, just keep writing it. You know, it'll be different enough. And I know that's true, but I just think it's so strange.
Yes. Yeah. But I mean what you just described, the thing where you either see like a movie or another book announced that is similar to the thing you're working on is like such a thing. That is this is like a year ago, maybe there was the new Safdie Brothers project, like after Uncut Gems was announced, and the description of it to me sounded like my novel.
Oh,
and
my God.
I sent it to a buddy. And he was like, yeah, I guess this is like a movie that's coming out. Like, what's the problem? And it's like, and you know, that was humbling in a way because it's like, yeah, there's the connections. I think on a lot of this stuff, it's like are more tenuous than we think, even if a lot of the beats are the same or even, you know, even just like broader connections can easily be made. I think so much of what makes the fiction that you and I love, you know, great, that we love, is, you know, truly what Lindsay Hunter brings to it, what Marcy Demansky brings to it. And that I think is kind of a hallmark of the kind of stuff that you and I really end up talking about forever and ever, is just like the really idiosyncratic stuff. So
it's true. You know, it's true. And I am nothing like her, although sure. Like I told you, I've been thinking in my head, like, okay, it's going to be like Bad Marie, but like on the road.
Right.
Although Bad Marie is on the road. And she wrote that too. I think I'm just going to have to read her book and then pivot to something else.
Yeah. That's funny.
But yeah, what's up with you?
You know, same stuff. It's just same stuff forever. Although I did have kind of a funny interaction this week, because I was thinking, you and I have never really talked about like agents before, like how we got agents or like any of that. But I had a funny interaction with my agent this week. Monica Woods is the best. I had submitted Old Open to her and never got a response. So I always thought like, okay, no big deal. Like that's whatever. And then I got a my other book got longlisted for a Penn Award. Mm-hmm. And so I was advised by a buddy, Christine Sneed, a great writer. Mm-hmm. She said, everyone that you want to work with that you have already queried, re-query them and tell them that you are nominated for a Penn Award. And it was really good advice. And I did that. And so Monica was somebody I reached out to again. I just said, hey, you know, I'd really love to work with you. I have 50 pages of a new novel, nominated for this award, whatever. And Christine's advice was, and I think this is good advice for anybody. You know, some of what you're doing when you're querying is just, you want to have a little bit of a hook, and whether that's, you know, being nominated for something or being, or just, you know, the nature of your project being related to something they've previously published or something that they have in kind of like their, what they're looking for section, you know, on their agency page, whatever. If there's some kind of connection, if there's some kind of hook, play that up. And so I re-queried her. We ended up, you know, working together. We still work together. She's great. So we were texting about just nonsense this week. And I said to her, I never asked you like why you passed on Old Open. And she, and this is, you know, I think we've been working together for like 4 years at this point. And she goes, you never sent it to me.
Oh.
And I was like, what are you talking about? And I was like, yeah, I did. And she's like, oh my God. She's like, so I pulled up the email and I had sent it to like at her attention. And, but it was like to a general email at the agency she worked at the time. She has her own agency now. And she's like, yeah, no, one of the interns just deleted that email. She's like, the first email I ever got from you was the one when you were nominated for that award. And I was like, oh my God. And I thought it was so funny because like all these years I had thought that she had just passed on that book, which ended up getting published by a really small press by, you know, Tortoise, which was a good experience. But like the whole time I was just like, oh, she just wasn't interested. Didn't like it. No big deal. And the email had just been deleted. She never saw it. So it's funny because I think that there's something in that that is instructive moving forward. It's like so many of these things like are so chancy in the world we're in, and you hear it all the time, and it is so cliche. Like it only takes one person, whatever, got to get lucky. But like really and truly, I believe that to my core, like it's true. It's not bullshit when people say that. And this is someone who, you know, is a big fan of my work and whatever, but she just never even saw it. Mm-hmm. And the whole time I thought she had passed on it. So I thought that was something I wanted to share because it was kind of funny. We both were laughing about it. It was like, holy fuck.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
No, I swear my whole career and even like my working career has been because I knew one person. Like one person got me in the door. One person believed in me, you know?
Yeah.
Like
absolutely.
That, and I've just like kept trying to like be open to those moments, yes. You know?
Yes.
They're hard to recognize sometimes.
Yeah.
Dang, I mean, Christine, you got to buy Christine a bottle of wine or something.
Christine's the best. We got to have her on. She'd be a fun person to talk to.
She's such a great writer.
She's awesome. I mean, have we even talked? I don't know if we've talked about how we've met on the show, but like, if you think about it, some lunatic approaching you at a grocery store and being like, I'm a big fan of your work. And your response was like, how the fuck, you didn't say that because you had kids with you, but the look on your face was like, how the fuck do you know what I look like? Unfortunately, you have to talk to me every week. It's just brutal.
No, that was so awesome. Like I told everyone, someone recognized me. They like my stuff.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I know. And look at us now.
Look at us now.
Weird.
It makes me think a little bit about when Joanna mentioned Jane Ann Phillips, I just like remembered being like 18, 19 years old again, and finding these writers that you truly had never heard of at all. And some professor or somebody offers them up to you, and it changes your life because yep. it opens up another path, and you realize, like, okay, what's this press they're on? Who else are they publishing? And mm-hmm. you're like, oh my God, there's
an you see entire... a place for you, you know?
Yes, where exactly.
As before, it felt kind of, it could have felt like a little closed off or like
yes,
untouchable, but then you find someone who's familiar or absolutely exciting, and you're like, I think I have something to say to.
Yes.
Who was it? And was it Patrick Somerville?
For that, that turned me on to Jane Ann Phillips?
No, that turned you on to Lindsay Hunter.
No, no.
Oh, I thought it was Patrick.
No, I read your stuff in Smoke Long. And yeah, they're great. And that's where I published my first ever thing. And then I just followed you and tried to understand, like, okay, where is she publishing? What is she doing? And I feel like the internet was a little different then. I feel like there were actually a lot more places at that time. Mm-hmm. Even, I mean, we're talking about like 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But I feel like 10 years ago feels really different than right now to me.
Definitely.
As far as journals. And I feel like you would see these same names pop up, you know, Borough Press, Smoke Long. There's so many places, but it feels smaller to me now. But also, to be clear, like, I am not in it the same way I used to be as far as like online lit journals trying to publish short stuff. But yeah, it felt like there were a ton of places back then, and there were a lot of people kind of trying to do the same thing.
It's definitely different. And I don't know how much of that is just like, I had to go have kids and
yeah, exactly.
Survive. Right. And I kind of lost the plot. Cause when we were talking mm-hmm. to Mallory last week, like the writers that she publishes on Maudlin House, like they're so new to me, you know, yes. but yep. I'm sure they're not, you know, like I'm sure they have a followings, and like, it's just, you know, some of it's just that I have not been in the game, you know, like I want to yeah. be in the game. Let me back in the game.
God, I kind of don't want to be in the game there. You know what? One thing submittable, like just the whole looking at submittable things, like moving from.
Yeah. That's the worst.
Yeah. That's something I think that, if you can excise that from your life and still submit in a way that works for you, do it, because it's crazy making.
I never look. I just like submit yeah. and then I wait to get the email that says no thanks.
Right.
Cause I don't. Yeah.
No.
Speaking of, if our listeners haven't checked out Tammy, which is the chapbook publishing oh, yeah. house and lit journal that Joanna runs, you should, because it is very good looking and very. It's got some really exciting yeah. writers. I saw Brian Evanson has a story in, I think, the latest no issue. Way. Yeah. So Tammy, check it out, everyone. Yeah. Other than that, like I read Alexandra Kleeman's latest book, Something New oh, Under man. The Sun.
You know what? I don't know if you texted it to me or if you tweeted it, but there was a paragraph in there that made me want to read that book. Like whatever oh, you,
my Lord,
there, did you text that to me or did you tweet that?
It was on Instagram. So neither.
Okay. Jesus.
It is filled with, I saw some, remember that dumb viral tweet that was like, there's no more novels of ideas. Mm-hmm. This is a novel of, I mean, it's hilarious and got a huge plot and, you know, there's a narrative, but there's also all kinds of ideas, and I could not put it down. Like I
carried. Had you read her work before?
No. And I know I always wanted to read You Too Can Have a Body Like Mine, but I've never read it.
What a great title.
I know. And I'm excited to read it because I absolutely loved this book. So good. And then I was kind of yeah. bereft because it was over. But I just so happened, I mentioned it earlier, Benjamin Labatut's book came in on my library holds, When We Cease to Understand the World. And I kept hearing about that book and I was like, I don't know if that book's for me because I'm a dummy. But I started reading it yesterday, I think. And it's like almost a perfect companion to Alexander Kleeman's book because it's,
wow,
it's about these scientific discoveries that were ruinous for humanity, but also for their creators and like mathematicians driven to madness. And some of it's fiction. He takes these real scientific discoveries and real people, and some of it he fictionalizes. But I think most of it is nonfiction. I'm curious to see how much, but it is just mind-blowing. And some of the stuff he's talking about in there, like these theories, are like, it's hard to fully understand or picture what these thinkers were getting at, but but it's okay. It's okay to understand that your intelligence is limited, or your knowledge of physics or relativity isn't where Einstein's is or whatever, but it's more about kind of like the ripples of what these discoveries did, you know?
Sounds amazing.
It's awesome. It's so good. It's on New York Review of Books. And it, I think it was a National Book Award finalist.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's, I'm happy to sometimes when I really love a book, the next book I pick up is a letdown, but, this is great in its own way.
I actually got more reading done than I have in a long time. I've read 3/4 of Socialist Realism by Tricia Lowe, which was a coffee house / Emily Books book. And
love that.
So good. It's nonfiction. And it's one of these books that the thing that I'm coming away from it with is just, it's really, really interesting in transition that it's, you know, it's, I guess, part memoir. You could almost call it a memoir, I guess, but the way the paragraphs are relating to each other, the way that she's getting in and out of things is just kind of amazing. And the kind of thing that makes me really excited. For some reason, I feel like transitions are something that when someone is doing it really well, it's one of the things that gets me really excited to start working on something myself. Like when you see someone really understanding how to get in and out of things and kind of keep you there, but also just, I mean, just be interesting and just keep moving is something that I find really like heartening as a reader.
Dang. How did you come across that?
You know what? It was recommended to me actually by Monica. She said, pick it up. She really liked it. And wow. So, yeah, but I mean, we had Hillary Leichter on here. That was another coffee house / Emily Books book. I think that most of those are kind of home runs, to be honest.
Yeah. I think didn't Emily Books, Margaret the First is really good. Mean is really good. Problems by Jade Sharma.
Oh my God. That book is like, people, have you read that?
Problems?
Yeah.
Hell yeah. Yeah. I loved it.
I want to read that.
Yeah. There's lots of, man, Emily Books. We love you, Emily Books. Women by Chloe Caldwell. Chloe Caldwell has a book coming out this year. The Red Zone, a love story.
Great title, Jesus.
A searching, galvanizing memoir about blood and love, how learning more about her period, PMS, PMDD, and the effects of hormones on moods transformed her relationships. We also watched Zola, the movie Zola. Have you seen it?
I don't think so.
It's based on that viral Twitter thread.
No, fuck no, no.
Okay. Oh, it's so good.
What is it? I don't even know what it is.
Yeah. So the basic premise is like this girl who does the Twitter thread, Zola, meets this other girl and they decide to go to Florida to strip. And it ends up being that the girl she just met is like allowing her pimp to use the other girl. And it's just like a crazy, wild, like funny, desperate story. And
I've never even heard of this. I'm looking at it right now. What the hell?
It's real good. Riley Keough is in it. I think the other actress is Taylor Page. I had never seen her in anything before. Nicholas Braun, who's great in Succession. Anyway, it was real good. And the best thing is that it's like an hour, 20 minutes long. It's so short.
Perfect.
You're in, you're out.
The only thing I've watched other than hockey recently is How To with John Wilson. Have you watched that?
No, I've heard that I would like it.
This is, oh my God, I love it. It makes me so happy. I was talking with somebody. It's one of these shows where, actually, I don't have many. It's not one of these shows. This show makes me so happy because of like the level of attention that is paid by whoever is editing it. I might be John Wilson. It might be somebody else. But like, it's just totally nuts. If you watch, if you have HBO Max, How to with John Wilson, I recommend it.
Okay. I'm on it.
I think you'll love it.
Good job.
Yeah. Decent job for, you know, three beers, woke up at 3:40.
Oh my God.
Decent job.
Oh, okay. Go to sleep.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop.